Dow Jones Industrial Average closes with another spectacular day. It's very encouraging. The Dow up 1,352 points, which is one of the biggest one-day gains ever. Okay, that's good news, right? And all of that is related to the fact that last night at 1:30 in the morning, the Senate unanimously passed this rescue bill. What is in it exactly? Well, we'll tell you about some of the good, the bad, and the ugly, and also speak with Michael Grunewald, who is editor-at-large at Politico, and suggests that we're making some of the same mistakes we may have made with previous rescue packages. We will get to that. He's not opposed to it. Nobody seems to be opposed to it. Well, maybe Bernie Sanders, but he voted for it, for goodness sake. Maybe because it included literally tens of millions of dollars, not billions, but tens of millions of dollars for public broadcasting. Really? Now, look, I understand they're in trouble, too, because they depend upon corporate contributions. They do. One of the dirty little secrets about public broadcasting is that the government only provides a very small portion of their budgets. It's below 20% that is provided by government at all levels. Most of it comes from, yes, listener support or viewer support on the case of public television, but the biggest chunk of all comes from corporate underwriting. And right now, some of these corporations, especially, I mean, I think Amazon's doing fine because people are ordering stuff online, but for goodness sake, the airlines are in all kinds of trouble. America's biggest exporter, Boeing, in all kinds of trouble. They'll be helped by the rescue package. It's not a bailout package. It's a rescue package. But what's sobering to me, and one of the reasons I can't breathe a sigh of relief, and I wish I could. One of the problems I have is I feel like right now in particular, broadcasting from home and dealing with all the same stuff that you're dealing with, and because everybody is, wherever you are, nobody is unaffected. This is horrifying and scary. I mean, when you have one of the presidents, one of the regional Federal Reserve branches saying, we're going to, within 3 months from now, hit a 30% unemployment rate when you have filed to date 3.3 million of our fellow Americans are filing for unemployment insurance. And people don't want insurance. They want a job. They want security. They want a future. And all of a sudden, to see this level of uncertainty, it's a terrible thing. What I was about to say, and again, with all of this coming in, and it comes in literally by the moment, and it changes, and it's positive, it's negative. One thing that I think is very serious, and I give them credit for actually reporting it honestly, is the New York Times reports that this rescue package is only going to keep our economy on life support for 3 or maybe 4 months. And then the experts, the economists, the policymakers, the politicians all seem to agree that they're going to have to go back for more. It's incredibly scary. And then what happens to the debt and the deficit? It still exists, right? And I understand that they're dropping interest rates and down to zero, so it doesn't cost anything in interest to borrow money, but still, there it is. At some point, the interest rates have to start coming back. And then for the government to have to pay interest on, what, could it go up to $40 trillion from our current $22 trillion in national debt? Yes, it could, easily. Easily. Especially if we are spending $2 trillion now, which is every bit of it is borrowed. And then we have to go back and get more a couple of months from now. Isn't something that conservatives wanted is to have a private economy, a free market economy that is not entirely dependent upon politicians borrowing money to keep us all going? This is a disastrous situation, and people are trying to deal with it. It's also a disastrous situation politically. Now, look, I do not want to make the claim that I think that Joe Biden is impaired somehow or senile, but something's not right. I mean, something is not right. And anytime you actually talk to Democrats who had invested a tremendous amount of hope in Joe Biden, his performance the last couple of weeks, I mean, since basically he locked up the primary the week after Super Tuesday, when he swept Florida, he won Florida over Bernie Sanders. And he didn't win because he was so impressive or so magical. He didn't win because he spent more money. Do you know where he ranked in terms of overall spending among the Democratic candidates? He was sixth. Elizabeth Warren spent more than he did. Pete Buttigieg spent a lot more than he did. Bernie Sanders is supported by all the millionaires and billionaires. Actually, he is supported by millions of people. But Bernie Sanders spent, I believe it's more than five times. No, it's 12 times as much as Joe Biden. And look where it got him. So Biden is the presumptive nominee, but there are a bunch of primaries that were canceled. Remember, they canceled the Ohio primary? They're now rescheduling it. And earlier this week, Delaware became the latest state to move its primary. It was originally scheduled for April 28th. It's now moved to June 2nd under an executive order by the governor of Delaware, John Carney. Pennsylvania's legislature is advancing a bipartisan bill that would likewise reschedule the state's primary from April 28th to June 2nd. Delaware and Pennsylvania would bring to six the number of states moving primaries to June 2nd. So on June 2nd, there are going to be primaries in Connecticut, Indiana, Maryland, and Rhode Island. The newcomers join the five primaries originally scheduled for that day. That's New Jersey, Montana, New Mexico, South Dakota, and the District of Columbia. And it's also Ohio, apparently. So there are going to be 822 pledged delegates who are available on that day. Now, why am I saying that in the context of, okay, people being very unhappy with Joe Biden's performance? Because Democrats are still always talking about, what are we going to do? Because if Joe Biden continues to perform so badly, I think there's going to be a tremendous upsurge on the Democratic side of we've got to go somewhere else. Bernie Sanders is unthinkable. He is a 50-state, I used to say 45-state. Yeah, he'd probably carry Vermont. But I really think that's about it. Bernie Sanders, no. But somebody else, and of course, there is backroom talk, and it's been reported to some extent, Andrew Cuomo, who has looked tough, competent. Now, Andrew Cuomo's a difficult guy. He is not a lovable puppy. But he's tough, very tough, right? But so are the problems. That was a slogan that was used in the Connecticut Senate race a long time ago. Okay, am I saying that there is a desire to have people write in Andrew Cuomo or something like that on June 2nd? Not yet. But with all of these states moving their primaries forward, it gives time for people to fret and to wonder and to talk about, is there any alternative to Joe Biden? The only other active candidate is Bernie Sanders. Everybody else has dropped out. Joe Biden was doing a virtual press briefing from his basement. Apparently, he's gone to great lengths to get the camera set up better. There's better lighting. It doesn't so much look like a hostage video as it did. But he was talking about the suffering of Generation Z, which is young people today. Listen.
Today, a new group of young people, referred to as Generation Z, is growing up in a time of pervasive anxiety about school shootings, crushing debt, and a politics that seems unresponsive or broken beyond repair. Now, students from grade school to college are being denied months of important milestones and experiences because of this pandemic. No spring semester, no spring break, no championship games, no year-end concerts, no graduations. And they didn't do anything wrong. But especially for those just entering adulthood or launching their careers, job opportunities, their dreams are being snatched away.
Okay, their dreams are being snatched away. Their dreams are going to be deferred. I obviously what Vice President Biden is trying to do is to gather some support from a group of young voters who overwhelmingly supported Bernie Sanders over Joe Biden. Must be because of Bernie Sanders' youthful vitality, right? By the way, I don't want to diminish or downplay the amount of discomfort that people are feeling who are in school. Particularly, one of the things that is happening now is colleges and universities are very worried that people who have already applied to those schools are actually going to enroll in the fall. And by the way, is there any certainty that we will be past this coronavirus hysteria in the fall of this year? Anyone who is certain of that is simply wrong. You heard Alex Barrazo on this show, and I'd urge you to look at his material because it's sobering. Yes, it is very likely that we will have a little bit of a reprieve in the summer, because the best guess, and it is still a guess, it's not a certainty, is that the virus will spread less destructively in the warmer summer months. But then next fall, winter comes back, and we potentially have another round. That was the situation we had with the great influenza, the Spanish flu of 1918-1919. It came around first, and the second round, after it had subsided and they thought they had the problem licked, was even more devastating. And as 675,000 Americans ended up dying, which is the equivalent in today's population of a little bit more than 2 million, which is about what the worst case scenarios are that people have sketched out by modeling from this situation. With all of this going on, I don't know what Joe Biden does. I don't know what Trump does next. If there is a big struggle over Trump's desire to reopen the country. And here's the problem, is that it appears, unless somebody has explained it to the contrary, and Jeremy, if you can find somebody who explains it to the contrary, please correct me. I hope I am wrong in this. But Trump mentioned this date of Easter in an interview. And he was asked about what scientists he'd consulted about, quote, reopening the country and removing restrictions come Easter time. He said, I just have a hunch. I have a hunch that this is going to be. And there are virtually no scientists, including the people who are working very closely with him, like Dr. Birx and Dr. Fauci, who will say, okay, yeah, we can get this done by Easter, and we can have people coming back to church. We can have people coming back to restaurants. We can have people coming back to university classes. We can do all of that because, again, that would be one of the most important things, would be getting kids back to school. One of the biggest hardships for people, more than giving up graduation, more than giving up senior prom, more than giving up the March Madness, that's gone, more than giving up opening day in baseball, one of the biggest problems is parents who count upon their children going to school, where the kids now can't go to school. And I know. So parents are trying to do homeschooling, and kids are trying to keep up online. And in a country where we have already seen great challenges in trying to upgrade our educational system, how does this help? It doesn't. The question that I'm posing is, they have a piece in the Wall Street Journal about President Trump's determination to reopen the country by Easter. He doesn't really have the right to do that, because all of these restrictions are imposed by governors, mostly by legislative action. And so what happens if we get to a situation where, say, Governor Jay Inslee of the state of Washington, or Governor Gavin Newsom of California, or Governor Andrew Cuomo of New York State — New York State now is very close to half of all the cases diagnosed in the United States are in New York State. And yes, that's a serious matter. And yes, Governor Cuomo is trying hard to get more ventilators. And yes, he was holding up this deal with Congress for a while. Okay. The point with all of this is, what does a citizen do if President Trump sends out the message, okay, you don't have to shelter in place anymore. I want people to go out. I want them to go out to church on Easter. I want them to go back to normal. But the governor says, no, my health experts in Washington or in California or in New York or in 20 other states says no. By the way, there are Republican governors who would say no. And then you have a constitutional crisis, right? I'm looking at this postcard that the president sent out. And yes, I was critical of it, because it says on the front of the postcard, President Trump's coronavirus guidelines for America. They're not President Trump's guidelines. Frankly, I don't care about President Trump's guidelines. I care about Anthony Fauci's guidelines. I care about Deborah Birx's guidelines. I care about Jerome Adams' guidelines. These health experts, even Vice President Pence, fine. But okay, President Trump's guidelines, the very first guideline that he has is, listen and follow the directions of your state and local authorities. What if those authorities disagree with the president? Can you imagine the disaster? Who gets to command the National Guard, for instance? Well, actually, it's the governors. And for people who worry about utter disaster, for instance, there's a piece in the Wall Street Journal where it says coronavirus prep is dividing couples. How many cans of tuna are too many? Some people are stocking up on food and supplies, though their spouses may not agree. 10,000 rolls of toilet paper. What are we preparing for exactly? Are we honestly facing any real prospect of not being able to get tuna in stores? First of all, I don't understand the deal about tuna. I mean, tuna steak can be very lovely, but tuna out of a can? Really? To survive on that? Maybe it really is end times. Certainly, they are not dealing with the tuna crisis, and the fact that tuna fish apparently in cans has been sold out almost everywhere in the new rescue bill. So will the rescue bill actually help us turn a corner, or just buy us a couple of months of breathing time before we have to come back for more? We'll talk about that with Michael Grunwald, who has written a provocative piece that reveals some of the crazy things that are included in this particular rescue package for $2 trillion of your money. It's actually not even your money. It's just putting you and your children and your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren in more and more debt.
Well, nothing to lose but your pain and the whole world to gain.
On the Michael Medved show, the confirmed cases in the U.S. for coronavirus are pushing up toward 100,000. Could be there soon. Deaths now over 1,000. Of course, still very, very far from the doomsday scenarios that some scientists have put forward. But we will get to that issue coming up on the Medved Show. First of all, something cheerful. Yeah, that's right. Everybody loves Christmas. And there were lots of goodies and treats and sugar plums of all kinds in this $2 trillion rescue package that passed the Senate unanimously last night and is moving over to the House the day after Nancy Pelosi's birthday, which is tomorrow. To help share the good news, I guess, is Michael Gruenwald, who has written an excellent piece on this process in Politico, where he is an editor at large. And Michael, first of all, help share the good news. And I thought this was the most encouraging thing I read in your article. And it was right at the very beginning of it, is that apparently the bill, as I understand it, does not include any money for windmills. Is that true?
It does not. It's funny. The one element of the sort of Democratic proposals, you see, President Trump and Mitch McConnell have been attacking the Democrats for, you know, oh, it's all about windmills. They're stuffing in the wind energy. This is crazy. They're doing another Green New Deal. I went through the 1,400-page Democratic alternative that they proposed, and it had just about everything but windmills. And they were, and in fairness, there was just about nothing in terms of renewable energy.
Okay, what is the deal with the $75 million in this package for Kennedy Center? I mean, I like the Kennedy Center. The acoustics are lousy, but I like the Kennedy Center and some of its programs. But $75 million of rescue money? The Kennedy Center is closed, isn't it?
Yeah, well, they ended up getting $25 million, and yeah, it's closed. I guess the idea is that since they're not going to have ticket revenues, they still have workers that they need to pay and janitors who aren't going to be getting a paycheck. But it's certainly a pretty roundabout way of getting people paid. My favorite item, I think, was that the Democrats wanted $26 million for overtime for TSA workers. And I don't know if you've been to an airport lately, but the TSA has never needed less overtime in its history. So
it is an unbelievable effort to
plus up all the usual programs that that members of Congress like.
Okay, what about this? You mentioned that there's $31 million in the bill for biosurveillance of wildlife. Is that to prevent new bats from flying over from China to infect us? What is that?
Yeah, it was something at the U.S. Geological Survey, and I don't think I went looking for it, and I didn't find that in the final bill. But they did include the Democratic proposal for $45 million for the Agricultural Marketing Service so that they could continue grading, you know, giving grades, you know, like USDA Prime for beef. And I think I mentioned in the piece that I didn't know if they would be grading pork with that money, but it seemed kind of appropriate.
Okay, when looking at this bill, I mean, it's as you point out in your piece, and I think your piece is profoundly wise. This is kind of inevitably what happens when there is some kind of a big, a complicated, one size fits all. Mission that you're on with something like this. The late Senator McCain used to decry this because anytime they were trying some kind of big sweeping bill, and he had a part in a lot of them, then there's all kinds of stuff that's inevitably loaded on. Are you satisfied, as many people are arguing, that, okay, there's a lot of stuff like this, it's a million here, it's a million there, it's 20 million here, 30 million here, that most of the money in this $2 trillion package is money well spent?
Well, I think you make a good point that a lot of these line items are pretty minor in the context of a $2 trillion bill. You know, I wrote a book about the Obama stimulus, the New New Deal, where the Republicans did an amazing job of making this bill that actually ended up doing quite a lot to end the Great Recession and start a recovery. But they just were relentless about finding items that they'd say was like, oh, it's putting sod on the National Mall, or, oh, there's honeybee insurance. And it really does, I think, turn people off. Now, I think, honestly, if you're going to look at this particular, not really, it's more kind of an emergency aid bill. But if you look at the $2 trillion, I mean, most of it is like they're giving people money. That's fine. They're giving money to states. That's fine. They're putting money in unemployment insurance. That's fine. There is this one gigantic question mark about the $454 billion that they're going to be giving to companies. Possibly through some sort of, Fed facility that they're going to stand up. And that, I think, it's very unclear, you know, how they're going to throw $450 billion at corporate America. It might turn out to be fine. It might involve, you know, giving money to companies while they lay off all their workers. We just don't know yet. So I think it's
fair. Well, I know for small businesses, at least for what I've read, Michael Grunwald of Politico, for small businesses, they get these money as grants to keep them going if they don't lay off any workers. But if they do lay off any workers, then they have to repay the loans. Isn't that the deal?
That's right. I actually think that the small business piece, which I have looked at pretty carefully, that's $350 billion. And it looks like it's really quite thoughtfully put together. And that was a bipartisan proposal that came out of Marco Rubio and Ben Cardin in the Senate. And you've basically described it right. It's they're going to give loans to companies on the condition that they keep their workers. And then the amount that it will basically be forgivable, these loans, to the extent that they keep their workers. So they'll get to keep the money that they paid to their workers. They also get to keep the money they paid for rent and utilities. The other part of the loan they will have to pay back if they ask for more than that. But it seems to me to be structured in a way that, like, yeah, we're going to give these companies money and so that they can keep their workers. I think there's a real question whether $350 billion is enough when, you know, just about every restaurant is closed and, you know, hotels and, you know, a lot of businesses that just have no business right now.
The difficult thing, it seems to me, is we don't know when those restaurants can reopen. And that's an item of some dispute. Let me ask you about that, because you're right there. You're covering everything for Politico. President Trump really, really wants America to, quote, reopen on April 12th. There are a lot of governors out there, including Andrew Cuomo, Gavin Newsom, many others, Jay Inslee in our state of Washington, who say no way, Jose, or no way, Donald. How does this thing sort itself out if there are a lot of experts and governors and Democrats and some Republicans who say, no, we got to keep schools and businesses closed?
Well, you've made what I would say is since this is an economic bill, and I think you've raised the most important point, which is that the number one economic priority for the country right now, and honestly also the number two and number three economic priority, has to be containing the virus, right? And there was $150 billion in this bill for various public health, for hospital beds, but I didn't see anything in specific for testing. And that's really the only way you're going to be able to restart the economy is if you really can kill the virus.
Let us hope that they succeed in that. Your piece is posted up at our website at michaelmedved.com. It's extremely important and informative. We will be right back with a tweet of the day, something generous and actually beautiful, and something not so beautiful, the idea of releasing prisoners to protect them from the virus. How about us? We'll get to that coming up on the MedVed Show.
1-800-955-1776. The Michael MedVed Show.
We're all looking for good news, right? This is kind of good news. No, it's seriously good news. The Wall Street Journal has concluded, and I do trust the Wall Street Journal. I think it's America's most reliable newspaper. And they write a new bull market has begun. The Dow Jones Industrial Average has rallied more than 20% since hitting a low 3 days ago, ending the shortest bear market ever. Wow. If that is true. Now, what they mean, a bull market, according to some definitions, is when a the market has gone up more than 20%. I think this is not a genuine bull market. We had a bull market before going for 11 years. It had been going. But may it only continue. I hope that they are correct. And then quickly, more good news, and this falls under our tweet of the day.
The page now to the internet.
I mean, wow, what a great, smart tweet.
Change his password so he no longer has access to his Twitter feed.
Did you send the tweet?
I did not send that tweet. My system was hacked. I was pranked.
Donald Trump hasn't tweeted at us once, and I'm starting to get worried about him.
So we have a new tweet.
All right.
Can I do the honors?
Stand by. Tweet alert.
This tweet is from a name you might recognize, Drew Brees. He's, of course, a longtime quarterback for the New Orleans Saints. Drew Brees puts out, Brittany and I are committing $5 million to the state of Louisiana in 2020. The priority now is helping our communities get through this tough time. After considerable research and conversations with local authorities, we've decided this is the best way to help. And that's a beautiful thing. And look, for people like Drew Brees, who've been so phenomenally blessed with athletic talent and leadership, decent guy, but this is exceptional. And yeah, today would have been baseball opening day, which makes me sad. There's a piece buried in the middle of the New York Times about opening day and the kind of stuff that would be fun to think about if they were playing baseball. Something I learned is there's a pitcher who pitched in the 90s who never lost on opening day, and he won 7 times. Now, to be an opening day pitcher, you've got to be pretty good. The guy's name is Jimmy Key, who did 7 starts with Toronto, the Yankees, and Baltimore. He had an opening day ERA of 2.64. He was 7-0 on opening day. Nobody else has ever done that. Let's go to your calls to David in Seattle. David, you're on the MedVed Show.
Well, you forgot one thing about that. Not only if you're good, you start on opening day, the opposing team's pitcher is their best. So you're also going up against the other team's best player. But that's not why I called. I think you may be contributing to the hysteria a little bit, talking about what it is in the constitutional crisis. I think all Trump said is he hopes they can start opening the economy up by Easter. I mean, I hope that. You hope that. Fox start
Greg
hopes that. And you're talking
of
about,
course.
Oh, well, what if Gavin Newsom disagrees? Well, then California will be...
No, they're both... Hold on. David, all of the major newspapers, the Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and Washington Post, and the Seattle Times ran one of the pieces from Washington Post, all of the newspapers are talking about, and they've spoken to people in the Trump administration who said, yes, the president is serious. The president's going to be speaking a few minutes from now, and we're going to go to him live, and he may be speaking about this very point. If the president continues, because he didn't just say it as a random thing, he has now said it repeatedly, and it's become sort of the Trump administration policy, which is that we've got to get our economy going again, and I think that's all true. And the question becomes, will Trump go forward with it if the experts and the governors and many other stakeholders in this say no? I hope not, because the last thing we need right now is some kind of a constitutional crisis. I do appreciate your call. I'll tell you something else we don't need is the release of thousands of inmates. There's a headline in Washington Post and another one in the Seattle Times. Washington Post says, disaster waiting to happen, thousands of inmates released as jails and prisons face coronavirus threat. Now, what's ironic with that is that they say the disaster waiting to happen is keeping these prisoners in jail. The problem is that there are security guards. There are prison guards who have begun coming down positive with the virus, which is a terrible thing. And which also in the close quarters in a prison, it can spread very, very quickly. What they seem to be talking about as this federal program, they're trying to get President Trump to commute literally thousands of sentences, but they're talking about for nonviolent offenders only, and for people who in many cases are elderly. Here's the way that Como Channel 4 covered the King County program preparing to release prisoners to limit the spread of COVID-19. Listen.
Could be a really big challenge.
King County leaders are making difficult decisions to reduce the number of inmates in our two county jails to prevent a COVID-19 outbreak on the inside.
One of the critical issues is not having so many people coming and going. People who might bring an infection in while they're at the jail for 12 or 24 hours.
So the work release program will be suspended for roughly 60 inmates. Instead of returning to the King County Jail after work, folks will return to their homes. 180 inmates held in King County for state corrections will be returned to state facilities. And the county has also asked that misdemeanants who have already been sentenced to serve their time will do so after the COVID-19 outbreak.
All their legal obligations remain.
In addition, the county is working with the prosecutor and public defender to stop bookings of lesser offenses that don't involve violence or a particular danger to the public.
We will be extremely careful. I know the prosecutor, the judges, everyone will be very careful to try to separate the wheat from the chaff and only release those they feel are not a significant danger.
Bottom line, says King County Executive Dow Constantine, anything that can be done to prevent the spread of coronavirus must be top priority.
Okay, why is it that I'm not filled with a lot of compassion and confidence when I hear something like this? I'll tell you why. Because there are so many cases, and you hear about it all the time, of someone who's just been released from prison. And this is in normal circumstances. It's not with this hurry up, let's release 1,000 people at once or 600 people at once. That's what we're talking about in King County. Even under normal circumstances, people are released from prison who go right back out and kill people or rape people or destroy property. And by the way, if the whole purpose is to avoid spreading coronavirus, how much do you think that people who are just released from prison are going to follow the guidelines and not to go out to bars? People are talking now about new speakeasies opening up in Seattle, right? Because you legally are not allowed to do a bar, so people do. That is a great invitation for some of these released prisoners, isn't it? Look, I just don't have confidence and the ability of this criminal justice system, particularly in King County, Washington, to judge people fairly as no risk to the public. Meanwhile, speaking of risk to the public, what do we have coming with this desire to reopen America? President Trump will be speaking about it coming right up in this greatest nation on God's green earth.